down in town.
For the first time.
This is Jim. And,
receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1408.DE0206, certificate number 31448. Wampum.
You are Matamwasas Kachayas. You, Quat Ananatam Mata Kachayas. Ananatam Neen Washka Hachik Matakim.
I'd like to start off the show by apologizing for having stolen native land.
All of it. Although they just got part of Oklahoma back. In a 6-3 Supreme Court decision, I think written by one of the conservatives, Neil Gorsuch, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't read this, but are they the native, the original aboriginal inhabitants of Oklahoma, or are they the residents of Oklahoma that were deposited there?
Yes,
due to the Trail of Tears.
Exactly. So Oklahoma was Indian. I mean, I don't even know what tribes would have been in Oklahoma before we moved everyone else there.
The original inhabitants of Oklahoma would have been the Apache.
Really?
Yeah.
They got that far east.
Yeah. And then...
It's funny how I imagine everybody being in western and worse lands than they were actually from. Weird. I wonder how that could have happened.
Well, the tribes that we think of as living in Oklahoma that were forced there were all the tribes from Georgia,
Florida,
and the southeast.
Yeah, Cherokees,
Cherokee and the Creek and the Choctaw and the Seminole. But those tribes, you know, they had much more verdant home countries.
No,
but the Apaches were from there originally.
Earlier this year, in the case of McGirt v. Oklahoma.
Oh, McGirt v. Oklahoma.
Newly minted seat stealer Neil Gorsuch joined the liberal justices in finding that the Creek Nation still had its 19th century tribal rights, including the right to hold criminal trials, like the state of Oklahoma does not have criminal jurisdiction over acts committed in eastern Oklahoma, which is really a groundbreaking decision for Native American autonomy and sovereignty, which had not been the way states had been interpreting that kind of stuff.
No, although I wonder
Let's say the way in which any white people have been interpreting, you know, Native rights laws for centuries.
Well, and we will talk about that today. What do you know about wampum? What does it suggest when you hear the term?
I almost feel bad saying it because it sounds like I think it's kind of a mid-20th century signifier for like a white person's misunderstood idea of native culture. So,
don't feel bad about that, Ken. Just lay right into it because that's pretty much we have to go on. No, it's not what it is at all, but that's where we start. That's our starting point.
Well, I think it's even the sounds of the word, and maybe that's why it caught on with white people, is it kind of sounds like a parody of Native American
Indian
English. Yeah, saying how and heap big warrior and, you know, me. Like there's some early movies and cartoons version of Native American speak, you know, terrible stereotypes that often involve ending verbs with an mm-hmm. sound, like me take 'em, him scalp, you know,
sure,
that kind of a thing, that wampum sounds like it's in line with. And
it almost sounds unreal, like it wouldn't have been an actual coinage.
Yes, if someone had told me there's no such thing as wampum, that's a Hollywood invention, just like you know, certain kinds of peace pipes and war whoops and all the rest. I would totally believe you, but that's not true. Wampum is a real thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shortened form of Wampanoag, which would have been a
tribe,
an East Coast tribe, but all of the kind of East Coast names, there are a lot of Native American names that, and words that were just hard for Westerners to pronounce and to parse, a lot of sounds that weren't in the sonic vocabulary.
And I'm sure we weren't trying super hard. But it probably didn't trouble us that much.
But it isn't a Western coinage. Wampum is what it would have been called at the time. But what do you think wampum is? What does it conjure?
I assumed, or it's usually treated as if it's Indian money. It has something to do with however their economic system of exchange works. And I don't know what that is. But it's... Actually, I just had to think for a second to make sure. No, you don't eat it. That's, what do you eat? Pemmican?
Oh, pemmican is dried beef. Right.
Isn't there some other similar word that becomes like, Indian trail food in other kinds of, I don't know what I'm getting.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I'm trying to think of what that could be.
Maybe I am thinking of pemmican.
Simoleons?
Yeah, probably simoleons.
Sit down to a big bowl of simoleons. Well, in that sense, you do eat wampum, because wampum is made from the shells of whelks and clams.
Oh.
So wampum is initially a food, or at least is the byproduct of food. So it's also kind of the source of why we call money clams.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, because it was, it's...
what a gift.
It's 100% manufactured from clamshells.
A lot of our money slang terms are edible, right? It's kale and spinach and dough and bread. And
yeah.
Like, we're not even sure what food group it is. Sometimes it's vegetables. Sometimes it's seafood. Sometimes it's carbs.
Right.
It's rarely meat. You never say, that'll be 150 McNuggets.
Yeah, who's got the beef? I mean, you're not talking about money. You're talking about
that's something else.
Well, and it makes sense because human beings, initial economies are barter economies or trade economies
of basic goods like food and
fur, right?
Fur is that basically
food, fur,
this
tools.
This is your Alaska side coming out. I guess now that upon reflection, the reason why I'm uncomfortable with words like wampum is because I don't know which of them are real and which are fake. Like I don't know if you told me that powwow or, I don't know, what's another example? Like papoose or squaw, these words that sound like they're of native etymology, it could be the other tribe saying something super rude.
Right.
There was some folk etymology that Oprah promulgated about squaw being an anatomical term.
Oh.
So it's like a really obscene insult. That turned out to not be true.
Right.
I mean, there are other reasons not to use terms like squaw for a woman of another race. As if it's another species that needs words for its young and its genders. That's why we don't say Jewess and Negress and words like that anymore, because it treats people of color like animals.
Right. Most of the Native American words that have entered into the European American lexicon were originally Native American words that had, in a lot of cases, like every word, much more complicated meaning, right, and kind of went through the squeezing aperture of being translated into a different language. And,
but sometimes from the wrong tribe, right? Like often we refer to tribes by the names their enemies gave them, for example.
Right. And a lot of that is complicated by pre-contact relationships between those tribes,
right,
but also post-contact and post-conquest, a lot of forced movement of tribes that were traditionally enemies or had no relationship or a contested relationship, being kind of forced together and being treated as a single entity because they shared a language group or a region.
We just assumed they were all the same.
Oh,
they speak for the whole coastline.
Sure, you're all Iroquois, I'm sure. And it's like there's 10 different groups of people that are like, what?
None of you are wearing shirts, so we're just going to pretend you're all... I mean, a lot of the Indian words, the Native American words we use without even thinking about it are the things we didn't have words for, like all the New World species.
Right.
Like animals like moose and caribou and skunk, chipmunk. Like those are all things we didn't have names for, so we borrowed the native words.
I always had a name for moose.
What did you call them?
Moose.
Oh, what a coincidence that you and the tribes agreed.
The thing is, look at it. What else could it be? What are you going to call it? Big deer?
But then like plants we didn't moose. Like, you know, squash and...
maize.
I think maize is probably not. I think But hominy is an Indian word, so is... I got a list here. Persimmon.
You're saying that the word pecan? Maize is not an indigenous word?
I would not have thought so. It certainly doesn't have like the
Oh, because it's Central American. It's a Central American word.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. It's not from the Iroquois, but it's from. Oh wait, no, it's Spanish.
But I think it's Spanish from Taino, which is a Caribbean people.
Right. I see.
So yeah, because I knew in Spain it was Maiz, but I guess it comes from.
It switches around. In Belgium, the first time I encountered someone in Europe using the word, a Belgian guy said, Would you like to join me in some delicious mice? And I was like, mice? And he was like, yes, we eat mice. And I said, I don't want mice. And he was like, it's an American food, mice. We went round and round.
Did you tell him, we call it maize?
My people call it maize.
So I'm too young to actually remember the Mazola commercial in question, but since you said that once on Omnibus, I've had a Bader Meinhof phenomenon where I keep seeing the references to We Call It Maize.
Yeah, that was a very popular commercial when I was a kid. And, you know, there was a lot of Native American iconography sort of post like American Indian movement, post capture of Alcatraz and Wounded Knee.
Do you think you think there was like a boom in it? Like as if it might be respectful to do it?
It was. You know, if you think about Marlon Brando refusing his Oscar or having a Native American woman receive his Oscar for him. Oh, no, it wasn't Brando. It was
Brando.
George C. Scott.
They both refused, but Brando is the one that that had some woman, I think, who was like a Puerto Rican woman or something, dress up as a... Like her name was Marie Louise Cruz. I guess she is part Apache, but she's half Apache, and she took the name Sachin Littlefeather because that sounded more appropriate to the movement than Marie Louise Cruz.
Right. But there was a period in the 1970s where it was a burgeoning awareness of
cause celeb
of Native American rights and Native American activism kind of took. Changed the conversation so that the kind of depiction of Native Americans in the 1950s as you're saying, just sort of the bad guys in cowboy movies and their depiction as primitive people was by the 70s and 80s starting, at least among academics and people of good faith, starting to become more
and maybe erring complex. In the direction of making them kind of idealized figures, you know, the crying Indian in the littering ad and the beautiful princesses on the margarine package.
This was a problem in or at least a state of affairs in the early contact period. The idea that they were that Native Americans were living in a state of grace. The whole idea that my people use every bit of the buffalo, just suggesting that they that being primitive was Acadian.
Yeah, in the I was watching the Terrence Malick movie about Pocahontas, you know, the New World. Have you seen it?
No.
It's pretty great, like, even if you don't like his more recent movies. But there's a part in it where the colonists often, the Jamestown colonists often call the locals the naturals.
Yes.
And I looked it up and there actually are historical documents where the naturals is the word they used. So as early as Jamestown, these people kind of had this idea of these slightly more than human...
people living in a state of grace.
Yeah.
And there was a huge difference between the Jamestown mentality... and the Plymouth mentality, because of the very different kind of people that settled in Virginia versus settled in Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, there was a much more, you know, the character of the Yankees was much more mercantile and much less philosophical in the way that the Jamestown settlers would have been more sort of aristocratic and also looking for native aristocrats, right? The idea that you could be born into a state rather than be educated into a state.
And I think it's very big in the Pocahontas story in particular that she's a princess.
Yes.
You know, they want to take her back to England and show her off to Queen Elizabeth.
And you don't see any of that in the Massachusetts relationships to the Native Americans that were living there. It's much more like who's in charge, who's the, you know, who's the chief, who has authority.
Can I speak to your manager?
That's right. I speak to your manager?
The Mayflower is a ship full of Karens.
But when Europeans arrived in the colonies, they did not bring a ton of money with them. If you can imagine, you're filling up your ship. Are you going to fill it up with seeds, or are you going to fill it up with bags of coin to take to a place where nobody's using coin?
Sure. I mean, we talked about how the army can't even get coins to Iraq and Afghanistan.
So when you're...
They should have used pogs on the Mayflower.
You mean cans of pog?
No.
Bottles of pog?
We've been over this.
when you arrive in a location like that, you're prepared to engage in a barter economy, particularly if you are... if you're there primarily to trade. The pilgrims were there, as we know, to establish a new utopia. But when the Dutch arrived in the New World, they were there primarily to begin to put trading posts and to collect fur.
And for that, you need at least relationships with the native people. You can't ignore them or try to convert them.
Right, and you have to have something to barter with. And the Dutch did, in fact, begin bartering with glass beads when they arrived. And this sort of apocryphal story of how the island of Manhattan was bought for $24 in glass beads is kind of, that's kind of George Washington and the cherry tree. But the Dutch did think of glass and jewelry, pretty things, as mediums of exchange.
So at first, there's not a sense that we're going to victimize these people with mere trinkets, cheap trinkets to us that they're easily impressed by because they don't have glass blowing? There could be some of that.
There's a lot of that. And trying to find something that functions as a medium of exchange. I mean, you can't arrive in a location and really immediately just sort of implement money on a new population. That has to be something they value. And a lot of times it's metal tools and guns.
That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying they didn't choose something that would have been valuable to both sides, like steel or silver. They started with something that a Dutch guy could produce very easily.
It's funny because, you know, bringing that stuff across the ocean also takes space on your boat. It's heavy. You know, it was not seen as nothing. And the Dutch saw when they arrived, I mean, all the colonists saw that these beads, strings of white, alternating sort of white and black or dark purple beads, were very, very prevalent among the first contact tribes and clearly revered.
The tribes were already wearing stuff like this.
The tribes were wearing not just necklaces, but belts, strands of woven beads, and they used them. They actively used them in daily life. They were exchanged. They were held in high esteem.
The Dutch were like, these are money for them. They thought this was the closest thing to currency.
That's right. This is money. And we have these glass beads. This is all this is sort of also fancy. And there was initially a kind of, maybe some curiosity on the part of the Native Americans, like, oh, glass beads. I guess you also have a bead.
You guys are into beads.
Oriented kind of culture. But
like beads, we like beads.
But there was not a money economy in the Native American world, what are kind of called now the Eastern Woodland Tribes, which is just a general sense, a descriptive idea for the tribes that occupied the east coast of the United States up to the Plains, and the Plains Indians being a very separate group of people.
And there would have been a ton of diversity there. We're just classifying them by like the order in which Europeans met them.
Yeah, and also, you know, there was a shared north, south, east, west economy of trade and of contact between those tribes, where the plains were a kind of dividing line culturally, and, you know, there wasn't, like, coastal trade at that time, but there would have been to the Great Lakes, there would have been down to Georgia, Appalachians, up to Nova Scotia, you know, the east coast.
And so tell me about the beads that the tribes were wearing. Are they, they're not glass. What were they using for beads?
So the beads were made from a couple of different kinds of whelk and clamshell that were only found in the waters between basically Cape Cod and, at the furthest, maybe Chesapeake Bay, but really located in Long Island Sound, predominantly in Long Island. In fact, so much so that the Lenape word for Long Island is Sewanaki, which is basically the name for the black shell of the...
The place where we get those
the hard
sweet
shell clams. Yeah. And the white shells, initially wampum just referred to the shells of the channeled whelk, the white shell, and eventually the word came to mean the combination of both. But the white shells and the black shells strung together on beads, or strung together on you know, hide or string made out of various sort of reeds or whatnot. Mm-hmm. They were an extremely symbolic language.
What, in the pattern of white and black?
In the way that the beads were made and in the patterns that they were woven together, and the both length and depth, they were incredibly sophisticated and interpretable documents.
What would they say?
Well, they said all kinds of things. And because they were only found in this one region, but used throughout the eastern woodlands as a means of communication, they had tremendous value. They were extremely rare. And in order to manufacture them, it was very labor intensive, because the shells didn't, if you can think about working with clamshell, it's not a very easily worked media. They worked meticulously to drill holes through these little shells.
They crack super easily. Yeah. The shells of my experience.
They had to be kind of worked with sand and water and polished in many stages. So it was not just a found object, right? It was a processed and produced media. But depending on the tribe and throughout the region, wampum belts were sometimes they functioned as passports. They were things that you would present when you traveled to kind of
TSA.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, to say, like, this is my authority. This is on whose behalf I speak.
Clearly, you can tell what village I'm from, right, who I'm speaking for.
They were credentials of office. If you became a tribal leader, you would inherit the wampum that denoted your station from the prior prior owner, I guess, or the prior caretaker of the wampum. Mm-hmm. Wampum was used to the use of names in pre-contact Native societies. Names were incredibly significant. In fact, there was a sense that the names were eternal, and that, like,
people's names, you mean?
Well, yeah. Like, if you think about the naming ceremonies of indigenous tribes, and how important a name is, and how much a name is something that in a lot of cases is discovered about you rather than bestowed upon you. There's also a long history of names going from one person to another, names that actually the wampum is the name, not just the station. And you can, when you become the chief, you can assume the name of your predecessor or reject it. But the name, the name continues on.
So wampum's a big concept. It's not just the thing. It's the halo of identity and history around the symbol.
That's right.
The symbolism it holds.
And incredibly, and the symbolism is both, it is something that you can apprehend at a distance and also then can be interpreted to pretty minute detail. Wampum was used to not just commemorate treaties, but actually to encode treaties.
So I'm really interested in this because you're talking about it like it's a language and, you know, it's made of white and black.
It's shells. On off.
Yeah,
it
reminds me of computer bits.
It's 1-0.
It's basically a binary language.
It is.
And because there's high contrast between them, it's also essentially pixels. You know, it's a little screen you can see at a distance showing patterns and lines and so forth. That's a kind of exchange that, you know, a computer scientist today would understand.
If you think about the language of the pre-contact people of the Andes that we've discovered over time is just knots on a string.
Right.
Also a kind of binary language. But these, most of the time it's symbolic design. Every once in a while you see actually like representational drawings within
wampum. Sometimes it might look like
very, 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 very rarely. That's not their original language. That's post-contact.
But does it ever have pattern? Like is the information encoded in such a way that there is abstract beauty going on in it? Or is it pretty much functional?
Well, this was the problem with the initial contact of the Dutch with these, with wampum belts, because it's very hard to explain, particularly if there's any kind of like deep language gulf. It's very difficult in first contact to see wampum being worn and being presented and being exchanged and understand that it is not money. It's not being held in value because it is rare and beautiful. It's valuable because it was rare and beautiful, and that was the media that we used to write our history, to write our philosophy, to communicate our like the eternal name of our ancestors. You know, like the value. It was made of gold, not because gold is valuable, but the value of gold is
independent of how nice the carving on the coin is.
Right, but
which is not true here.
But we did choose gold because we value the concept so highly.
Right, but if that's your thing, you kind of forget. You know, you kind of miss the history of how your symbols formed. And these first contact Europeans, they rarely erred on the side of assuming the complexity and legitimacy of the people they were dealing with.
But it would have been a completely unprecedented, uncomprehendable language to someone coming from Europe who at this point has, you know, is dealing with language and is...
you don't know all the reference points. Yeah, you don't know about Darmok and Jalad when the walls fell.
Right. But also to encounter a group of people that are using what appear to be media of exchange and not impose an idea of money on it, at least for the Dutch.
Or are you giving the Dutch credit for not making everybody switch to guilders immediately?
Well, they very quickly did.
Because this show is not often a pro-Dutch podcast.
We do take the Dutch down a peg, and rightfully so, but the Dutch of all people in the world are going to see any two things being exchanged as a money economy, just because it's...
Oh, I see. Those people.
Yeah, I don't want to be racist against the Dutch again, but they really do see things in terms of trade, right? Money and trade. And that was, of all the people that from Europe that were encountering the Americas, the Dutch were like not there for religious freedom,
not there to baptize,
not there to build a new Russian build a new Nederlander aristocracy there. They weren't really there to enslave people. They did that other places. What they were there to do was trade, to take fur out and to bring tea in, you know. New York City, even today, basically has a Dutch mentality.
They see America as a big vending machine where you put tea in the little slot and you hit the button, ka-ching, 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 and beaver pelts come out the bottom.
So what they started to do was say, oh, you use wampum. Well, we'll use wampum too.
We've got our Dutch wampum.
And the Native Americans were, I think, kind of rightfully like, a lot of those initial contact relationships involved the kind of both inhabitants, and it's strange to say now, given the, or I mean, it might be controversial to say, but there was a lot of attempt at goodwill from both parties. I mean, it was not initially completely driven by an exploitative nature on either side, but it's like, oh, here are new people. Here, let's try and figure out a way to meet some common ground.
The Dutch had read their business books. They'd read Getting to Yes or whatever.
Well, even as late as Thomas Jefferson. I mean, Jefferson believed that there was every opportunity for Native Americans to be fully fledged members of American society. It's just that his prejudice was that what...
Once we civilize them, is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, that everyone wants to leave behind a nomadic lifestyle to become a farmer. And so Jefferson spent, you know, so much effort trying to work with the native tribes to encourage them to settle. And the fact that they didn't want to settle was incomprehensible. But it wasn't that Jefferson
just evidence that they're doing it wrong. Or as long as you guys keep on living in the woods.
Like, so, it was so baffling.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, there was a lot of colonial, just failure to know what to do with a nomadic society. And it wasn't, the impulse was not always to just destroy, but in trying to interact.
You're still going to destroy if you.
You're going to destroy, yeah. Right? Because you cannot have a society based on property and ownership and not conflict with a nomadic one if you're trying to share the land.
If Thomas Jefferson wanted me to go work on a farm, I'd be like, no way, man.
I know.
That's what I'd say.
You're like, I'm a nomad. I'm a rebel, Dottie.
I think I'd say, I live in a city. Plus, I know how you treat the people on your farm, or at least the good-looking ones. Well, John, we're getting to the end of 2020, and I have a few notes.
Oh, are you going to review 2020? Because I feel like that's a longer show.
I just have some issues with 2020. There are a few things about it haven't been ideal. I don't want to always be Mr. Nitpicking Guy.
Sure. I mean, are you talking about personal things like you had a hangnail, or are you talking about something more general like...
Well, just kind of the general state of global social and economic and political chaos and crisis.
Right. The fires in California. That, it was very smoky here for my birthday, which was not that cool.
Wow. So yeah. Basically it's all about your birthday.
Meh.
But one good thing that happened in 2020 is Omnibus actually became financially viable.
That was a wonderful day.
Thanks to our Patreon supporters. It's now been just over a year since we started our Patreon and made our benefit tiers available. Our supporters get things like access to an additional bonus episode every month, the video and still images on our image feed, signed show notes. What else we got? You can suggest a show topic.
We actually will talk to you on a Zoom call for 45 minutes to an hour.
We've been chatting with some of our supporters, and that's been fun.
It has been fun.
And because it's been a full year since some people have donated, I just wanted to.
Oh wait, do their benefits re-up at the start of the new year?
Yes, those are annual benefits. So not only do you, if you continue to give to Omnibus through this, you know, into 2021, not only do you keep your access to the bonus episodes and the image feed on Patreon, but you're also going to get a new set of signed show notes. And we didn't know if people would want to, so we're also signing and sending you a chick tract of our choice.
Uh-huh. We spent a long time signing some chick tracts.
We're not endorsing any of the particular messages in these chick tracts, especially the evil ones. But we just thought it would be fun for you to have.
You know, I came downstairs and it was clear to me that my daughter, a comic book lover, had gone through the Chick Tracks. And I'm not
sure. Did you have to explain that the Catholics are not actually all in hell?
Yeah, I mean, there were.
With the Jews and the communists?
When we put the whole of the Chick Track world together, boy, it tells a pretty dark story of human life. And so I just discovered that today. I haven't gone and talked to her about it.
If we do send you a signed Chick Track, maybe wait till you're in your happy place to read it, because it might bum you out otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, if you read it as hilarious, campy, like late 20th century apocalyptic garbage.
Outsider art.
Then they're wonderful, but don't believe a word of them, except for the trucker one.
Yes, except for all the stuff that's true.
Yeah, right.
That goes for the bigger rewards as well. If you're still donating to the show at the washing bear level, you'll be able to choose a new show topic in 2021.
Nice.
If you donate at the Omniversal Hypercoral level, John and I will be happy to chat with you again, through the miracle of, Zoom or Skype or what have you in 2021.
We also have t-shirts available now, for futurelings that want to rep the show out in the world.
You can go to omnibusproject.com/store to see what merch is currently available. We're going to continue to supplement that.
But really, patreon.com/omnibus has made such a difference in our lives and such a difference in just the pride we have in the show and the fact that it is self-sustaining and we were able to cast off the yoke of our corporate overlords. It's really been validating.
It's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Oh, that's what I meant.
If you go to
say.
/omnibus, you'll give to somebody else, which would be nice.
No, don't do that. patreon.com/omnibusproject. Don't be nice. Just be nice to us.
So if you did give in 2020, you can continue to receive those benefits as long as you're a supporter. If you've considered joining, now is a great time. Join the well over 1,600 Omnibus supporters who are enjoying these benefits of the show.
Thank you, everyone.
We love you.
God bless us, everyone. One of the first treaties between Europeans and the indigenous inhabitants of North America was a treaty called the Tawangashi Treaty in 1613.
Ooh, that's pre-Plymouth.
Super duper early, between Dutch traders going up the Hudson River and the Mohawk Confederation. And this treaty was written in wampum. And it's called the Two-Row Wampum Treaty.
I was going to ask, like, is there any way the Mohawk tribes really knew what they were getting into? But I guess if the Dutch took the trouble to...
Well, it's the
to other... To negotiate the treaty in wampum.
It's the other way around.
Huh.
In this exchange, there was a very sort of high-level meeting of Mohawk leaders and Dutch traders. And they came together and agreed that they would, that there was room here for everyone, that they would share the land, that there would be mutual respect. And
I always wonder how this happens with a language gap.
Well, this is the thing. This was all encoded in wampum, which the Mohawk
they're fluent in wampum, man.
It had tremendous legal, in our sense, it had tremendous standing.
Yeah.
It had tremendous weight.
Very authoritative.
And also, like, basically at the level of religion and civilization.
Yes, it's right? Ceremonial.
The wampum encoded this treaty. Between what the Mohawk at the time perceived like, okay, well, here are white people, and here's the deal. We will share our land with you to the degree that we're capable of all living here together in peace. And this wampum, which was, by all accounts, completely... The Dutch who were engaged in this treaty had no idea of the symbolism of the wampum itself.
They're just like, yeah, there's two kinds of shells. We get it.
Yeah, they're like, oh, this is beautiful. What a beautiful belt. Thank you.
Oh, I see. So they got handed the belt and thought it was a token of the deal.
Or something.
Yeah.
And the thing is, what we can't know, the Dutch did not also have, there's no Rosetta Stone. the Dutch did not then write the treaty down in Dutch and the and did not equate it with this belt. And so to this day, the native tribes of the East Coast will refer to the two-row wampum treaty as the first treaty between American Indians and whites, and they are for many centuries have felt like we wrote all this down the first time we met, and you have betrayed every tenant.
So it was also the first broken treaty. Yeah, what you're
saying. It's like this is the document upon which all subsequent treaties are based.
Look at the belt.
So every subsequent treaty between those tribes and European adventurers and then ultimately societies was predicated on a prior knowledge of this treaty
in the Mohawk mind.
That's right.
And none of the white people they were dealing with had any idea.
So what the Dutch did was they seized upon this idea that wampum was a thing that had a lot of importance, and it was a thing that they saw it was difficult to manufacture, but with the introduction of iron tools and the introduction of sort of Dutch mass production, they could make wampum. If that's what we're calling money, they can make wampum a lot faster than the traditional methods.
Even if it's just glass, all you need is sand and heat, and you don't even have to ship that over.
Well, and they saw the difference. Wampum was revered, and glass beads very quickly sort of were like, oh, yeah, that's pretty and everything.
They're like pogs.
But
they're a fad.
The native tribes were like, no, with the glass beads, but okay, wampum. And they didn't, the wampum that was being delivered to them did not have any, it wasn't written.
They're just getting nonsense wampum.
It was just nonsense wampum.
Your wampum sucks.
But they did use that wampum themselves for so many different aspects of society that it did have intrinsic value. It was in the same way that gold.
Sure, we'll take more shells.
Yeah, well, we can use these. We can turn these into all kinds of things. Like, okay, sure. And it was very gradually, although within a pretty short amount of time, that the tribes recognized that, wait a minute, you're using this in a different way. You're using this as money, which is a kind of a new concept, but that's not how we use it. But there was also an explosion of trade at this time. Fur and, a lot of need for sort of all of those encounter economies, and a lot of competition within the tribes for those trade relationships, and a lot of competition among European settlers, the Pilgrims, the Dutch, the Jamestown people, the people in Delaware, the Philadelphians.
You've got your choice of white devils to deal with.
And every one of those white devils is in competition with one another for those trade relationships with the tribes. So a lot of the conflicts were based on how do we get exclusive rights to trade with the Mohawk, or exclusive rights to trade with the Oneida. And the Oneida are also looking to kind of ace out their competitors and maintain those relationships with Rhode Island.
I wonder if there's more buyers and sellers on the Indian side, which makes it a real race to the bottom, because, you know, the whites have more power to be like, hey, if the Oneida won't deal, we'll go to the Seneca or whatever. Whereas there's more, but it might be a little more limited the other way. You know what I'm saying? There's more natives to deal with than there are new arrivals for a while.
That's right. And it changes an awful lot between 1615 and 1650. I mean, a very short amount of time, but during that time, there are waves and waves of new arrivals from Europe who are establishing new towns, whole new civilizations, right? Every new group is like, we're the Quakers. We do things this way. We Quake or whatever. And
yeah, that's what they said.
So they're in immediate competition with other Europeans.
And imagine at first the tribes would have been like, you know, these guys won't stay. You know, this isn't going to permanently rechange our landscape. Let's just do it the best we can while they're here.
Or based on this two-row wampum treaty, we all have a deal that like, okay, they keep building these fences.
They not looked at the upper left part of the wampum?
I mean, it's super weird about the fences, but okay. But generally, you know, in general, like
they're hopeful.
We're sharing this land. And if you're all about a fence around your little house, like that's fine and everything. But there was just a real lack of shared values when it came to when it came to private property, but also when it came to the value of media. I mean, weirdly, pelts, fur pelts that had been worn by Native Americans for a period of 6 months to a year were more valuable on the Western market than raw fur pelts.
More valuable to Europeans.
To Europeans.
Well, now, why is that? Previously owned.
Because in wearing them for 6 months, they took the rough hairs, you know, they wore the rough hairs off of the fur and made them silky smooth.
You don't want new car smell on your pelts.
Right.
You want.
So actually having the tribes wear the furs for a season, you know, like imparted more value, more seasoning.
This is your vintage thrift store aesthetic. you only wear pelts that have been worn by a brave for a while too.
Well, so what happened was the Dutch started to manufacture wampum and started to industrialize it.
Did they use real shells and just harvest them faster, or did they find shell substitutes?
They used real shells. They started to, they just had much more efficient ways of drilling shells, polishing shells. Mm-hmm. Gradually, they did start to, because black shells were more valuable than white shells. Harder to find, rarer.
I assume.
The Dutch started to dye white shells black.
Hey.
I know. And then eventually...
They're wampum counterfeiters.
Eventually, they started to impart like actual exchange value to shells so that 8 white shells equaled 4 black shells, and 4 black shells equaled 1 stuiver, which was 20 stuivers to the guilder. And... then there was,
and the tribes probably weren't aware of all this, and maybe would not have shared the ratios.
Tribes were just like, oh, I don't know, man. But the influx of wampum, you know, because this is the thing about the Eastern Woodland tribes. They all used wampum, even if they had no, even if they weren't tribes from the coast, right? Mm-hmm. All the way into Pennsylvania, Ohio, wampum was still used in this way. It was part of what made the tribes of the East kind of, you know, it was their contribution, I guess, to the larger civilization of the time. So all this extra wampum at first kind of was a boon. It did get then turned into belts. It was used to document. It was a storytelling media. So you could, in a belt, recount the story of a hero of the tribe in general, of an event.
This is true on our money today. I mean, in a very, very minimal way. If you want to see Yosemite National Park or something on a state quarter, like we commemorate leaders and not battles so much, but buildings. We're more into buildings.
We do like buildings, not as much like...
We always pick buildings that kind of look the same, like this coin. Is this Monticello? Is this the Supreme Court building? Who can say, really?
Right, they're all Greek Revival buildings.
Yeah, exactly.
Other countries have cool money that have airplanes and stuff on it, maybe one day.
Yeah, they have, even the European nations are now like really have an eye on a broader array of symbols, musical instruments and animals, and we haven't really caught the vision.
Yeah, soon, I guess. I don't know. Maybe.
We can't even get Andrew Jackson off our money.
I don't know. The last election, which just happened earlier this week, maybe it has produced a new generation of...
Do you guys have a new currency already in the far future of November 5th?
We're back to wampum. I think one of the recognitions that wampum was valuable in this way, it happened pretty early on. A Dutchman by the name of Jacques Elkins... kidnapped a Pequot sachem, which is, you know, a tribal leader,
yeah,
and held that Sachem for ransom, hoping to, you know, be presented with a bunch of furs or whatever. This was kind of, you know, this was the dark side of any frontier is just this, like, everyone is in a state of total desperation all the time. And what happened was the tribes arrived with 280 yards of wampum as
ransom.
What he considered ransom. Now, what they meant by it was,
if you actually read the wampum, it says, well, "Please stop kidnapping us."
What the wampum was all of the wampum that that told the story of this Sachem and how important they were, and they were the wampum of that, of the office of that person. They were much more than just like, here's a bunch of wampum, give us our guy back. It was much more like a symbolic sort of like, in exchange for this person, like, here is the story of this person. And that was kind of one of the triggering events for the Dutch, like, whoa, this stuff is really, they hold this stuff as it's just valuable stuff.
And did they realize why?
No.
Oh.
That a lot of this information about the importance of wampum has only come as in the subsequent couple of centuries, as the tribes have had the opportunity to explain its significance and their and themselves.
So it's coming from their own oral histories.
Yeah.
Our written ones were always missing the point.
Because most of this wampum did not survive to the present day. The industrialization of wampum production caused wampum inflation.
You hate when that happens.
So that all of a sudden the markets were flooded with wampum. They no longer, and they had been divorced of meaning.
Sure. If the Dutch do it, it's just monkeys on typewriters.
Right.
You get some wampum and it says, you know, pencil, rectangle, orange halo. And you're like, what? I don't want that wampum.
And during this sort of late, during the sort of 16th century transition, when there were a lot, when the colonies started to do a lot more trade with the Caribbean, sort of the slavers and rum runners of that period, that was a real Caribbean economy, but they were using doubloons and reals and coins,
Spanish coinage.
And so that coinage started to come into the American colonies as a medium of exchange. And so the need for wampum, you know, once you had an exchange rate, like how many wampum are equal a real, and there's wampum inflation, pretty soon the wampum goes away.
The good money will be hoarded, just like on C-Day. Everybody will prefer the more stable currency.
Right. It was legal tender in New England from 1637 to 1661.
Wait, in England?
In New England.
Oh, in New England.
In England, it never made
it. I thought it like made its way over some reverse British invasion. Yeah, we're all using Welks, man. It's the new thing.
In New York, it survived as legal tender as late as 1673. And its use as a symbolic media was not lost upon the colonists in their time in the subsequent couple of generations. So much so that George Washington made a wampum treaty with the Canandaigua.
As president?
Canandaigua. Let me do that again. George Washington sort of commissioned a wampum treaty called the Canandaigua Treaty, which is a 6-foot-long wampum belt that has 13 human figures holding hands, representing the 13 colonies.
So it's got images in the
wampum.
And this would have been as when he was president, so more than a century after.
Yeah, it's from 1794. So
the tribes were still using wampum internally for its symbolic value.
I think the tribes, even to this day, still feel like wampum has tremendous symbolic value. And a lot of the wampum belts that you see in museums around the United States are, there's a movement to repatriate those to the tribes, because sitting in a museum, we're still doing the thing where it's an artifact and not a living document, but to the Iroquois, that wampum belt may be not just symbolic, but sacred.
But at least we're not saying anymore, that's 17 guilders.
Right. Although there was a company that started by John Campbell in Passaic, New Jersey, that manufactured wampum until the 20th century as increasingly, you know, a decorative bead.
If you want Indian decorative items, I think feel like you would want them made by the tribe. You'd go to Native Americans. You wouldn't go to some guy with a factory in, what did you say, Passaic, in somewhere in New Jersey?
Yeah, well, and that is, there's now wampum being made as a Native art form, using traditional methods.
Probably with representational images now to make it prettier for your Cape Cod vacation house.
It's weird. You see that a lot in Native American crafts that are made for Western audiences.
The war rugs.
The Thunderbirds and the orca and whatnot. And a lot of it, a lot of that is really from the language of the Haida, for instance, out here in the Pacific Northwest.
That's the animal imagery you often see, like on the Seahawks logo.
Yeah, and the totem poles.
Yeah.
But there is, I mean, even some of the most valuable Native American rugs and jewelry were made for trade, and not, you know, the things that really had symbolic significance. A lot of those things didn't survive. Didn't survive that period of encounter and, you know, apocalypse, really. I mean, there just weren't the methods of transfer. A lot of those names died.
So it was the less important stuff that got traded to the Dutch or the British or whatever, and therefore survived. And a lot of the stuff that represented the tribal identity better was lost.
I mean, there are some of the most important of those belts that do survive. The Hiawatha belt, or Hiawatha belts, I guess, is a kind of belt, but there is a Hiawatha belt that symbolizes the unity of the five tribes.
Created by Hiawatha, the legendary chief?
Well, no, but symbolizing, I mean, Hiawatha is one of these, he was on the shores of the Gitche-Gumee. but
is he a semi-mythical figure? Or?
He's become mythical, but he was a real chief, and one that...
This is a data point, by the way, in your 20th century, you know, redesign of Indians. Disney makes Hiawatha into a cute little Indian urchin. You know, he's not a strong warrior. He's kind of been defanged and made a roly-poly little kid in deer hide.
Right, isn't that... And is that recently?
No, that was like a 40s and 50s kind of thing where, you know, and I'm sure Disney thought they were doing the right thing by making a sympathetic Indian protagonist, but what they're really doing is turning a warrior into a cute teddy bear that you don't have to be scared of.
Yeah, Hiawatha himself died, you know, prior to first contact.
Yes.
And just prior. But it was really, you know, the first time he was turned into a chubby little friend was...
Longfellow?
It was Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha, which was, what, 1850s?
But at least there he's actually doing warrior stuff. I mean, yeah. he's doing it in a Finnish rhythm and meter.
But that's the Acadian version, right? That's the the Native American as...
Bucolic.
Friend
of nature.
Son of nature.
Mother right. Nature's son.
Mother Nature's son. Doom, 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 doom. In the final irony, well, in the penultimate kind of not irony.
Let me know when we get to the ultimate irony. So what was the anti-penultimate irony? I guess Hiawatha being turned into a little kid was the anti-penultimate irony.
And the penultimate non-irony is that the tribes of the East Coast are now starting to manufacture wampum. And there is some aspect of that where they're not doing it for tourist dollars. They're trying to, in the same way that the Welsh are trying to recapture their dead language, this is more than a language. The writing of wampum is like profoundly important. And there's recognition of that in the tribes that are beginning to pursue and try to rediscover what that symbolic language was.
I mean, even if it's only done in a token way, it keeps, I mean, you know, in a way that doesn't actually, is no longer central to their economies or belief systems, or at least it keeps it alive so that, you know, it doesn't get to where there's only three people who understand how wampum worked and then nobody.
Right. I mean, the fear, and I think the final irony, is that wampum, because it was used throughout the Hollywood era and throughout the 19th century as a kind of very recognizable decoration that signified Native American, right? You could put a wampum necklace or belt on someone and
probably an Italian actor.
Yeah, regardless of what it would have symbolized, it now became a decorative element. Mm-hmm. And so then that decorative nature of wampum then did become its own use case of that material. It is just beads. They are just shiny beads. They are puka shells. And puka shells probably have a symbolic meaning that I don't understand, but it didn't keep me from wearing a puka shell necklace all through the
70s. Well, there's something universal about even today for an industrialized nation, seeing a shell on a beach and admiring its beauty.
Right.
I mean, that's survived.
So there is then also a market for wampum as jewelry. And you see in this, and this is not the episode on cottagecore, it's coming, but I hear from a lot of people. I got a letter from a friend the other day that said, there's this Pendleton coat I saw at a store and I really love it, but it's made out of a Native American blanket and I'm not sure if it's cultural appropriation for me to buy it.
Right.
What do you think? And I was like, it's a Pendleton jacket that was made for you. It's not a
you're overestimating the authenticity of this design.
This blanket is not did not ever mean anything. It's a Pendleton jacket. It's meant for white ladies. But that sensitivity to cultural appropriation means that a lot of these native handicrafts that were always meant for white people to wear now are making people feel weird or insecure.
Just like me not even wanting to say the word wampum because I don't want to get it wrong. What if is wigwam okay? I don't know. Send me a list.
Right. It depends on how you use it and how you mean it. But there's this whole fashion school of people in Palm Desert wearing giant hats with feathers in them and turquoise belt buckles and wampum chokers that I think if any native American would look at and just feel like it was such a jumble. It's sort of like, it's like any contemporary style. Like you have no sense of where the origins of these things are and what they would ever have symbolized to us, but they symbolize to someone in Palm Desert that you have money to burn and you left LA is what they mean.
I think the only appropriate thing to wear is tall black hats with buckles.
Tall black hats with buckles, because you're...
Then you're on safe ground, and wooden shoes.
You're part of the... Oh, I see. Really tall black hats. I thought you were talking about like a Waylon Jennings look. But Waylon Jennings is just a pilgrim that's got the top of his hat chopped off.
Yeah, that's how he got his look. He was... you know how Pepe Le Pew always gets a stripe on his back or whatever? Waylon Jennings was always like walking under low bridges and stuff. And I think that's what's safe for white people to wear. You can just wear pilgrim hats and wooden shoes everywhere, and you're above critique.
The final irony is that 98% of the wampum you're going to see now, which is still not very much wampum.
I see very little wampum.
But 98% is made in China. Because...
Do they have the same welks?
Because it's the global... No, I mean, anytime you go into a raw bar at JFK or Grand Central Station and order a big bowl of clams, you're eating those quahog clams that... Are the black shells of wampum.
Well, I mean, that's a good metaphor for being in Manhattan anyway, if you're just eating money.
Right. That's why we can't tax the rich.
Down it goes. And that concludes Wampum, entry 1408.DE0206, certificate number 31448, in the Omnibus. The Omnibus is a important... educational and cultural institution of our time. It's kind of the wampum, in a way, of the podcasting world, hoping to transmit some of the important values of our culture that we think will probably be lost soon when the alien pilgrims and Dutchmen arrive. Try to stamp out our culture.
They are, omnibus episodes are passports and documents of authority and authenticity.
Letters of transit. You can go anywhere in the world with an omnibus t-shirt.
Sure. I mean, if you're standing at a border and the guard is like, no passe, you can just hold up your phone and say, you've got to listen to this omnibus episode on mail trucks.
Ah, es el episodio de los camionetas del correo. Es un bueno. And then he'll let you ride in.
Right in. The little stripy gate will come up and...
But in addition to its educational aims, the omnibus had in order to better propound and diffuse those aims, the omnibus was available on a series of social media networks, each worse than the last, as at Omnibus Project. I'm at Ken Jennings on Twitter. John is at John Roderick on Twitter and Instagram, where he sends pictures of broken bathroom fixtures, mostly.
That's kind of your brand. That's lately, broken bathroom fixtures and dirty pants.
It's so upsetting because you really want your house remodeled, but people keep sending you broken bathroom fixtures. That's not going to get the house remodeled.
Yeah, I was texting with a friend back east, and I said, you know, how's your quarantine going? And he was like, oh, I've got this cat that's got a skin disease. And I was like, oh, gross. And he said, yeah, you keep posting pictures of your dirty pants.
But you have a very cute
who
cat.
Who are you to talk?
You have a cute cat to post pictures of.
I do. That's a
so
cute
you're really
cat.
Showing him up in the feline the department.
I'm not a cat poster.
You've put up a few.
Couple.
Are we allowed to name the cat? Are you saying the name of the cat on your podcast?
You can name the cat.
Yeah. Okay. Because the cat is too young to consent to its online persona.
That's true. But it's a cat.
But Allie is a beautiful little kitten.
Oh, that's sweet of you to say. I had nothing to do with it. I barely know what to do. But Alieska is the name of the cat, and she has decided that I'm the one safe harbor. Everyone else wants to pick her up
and prods at her.
Yeah, and just throw her around, and I'm the one place that...
And you don't care.
When I'm laying on the couch, she will come and tuck herself in, you know, into the crook of my arm because she knows that I'm not going to pull her hair.
Isn't this also your approach to women?
Yeah.
If I pretend like I don't care about poking and prodding at you, maybe you'll come to me.
Yeah, you just lay there and rest your weary head on my shoulder and...
You could also send us physical items at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Send us your trade goods, trans-temporal Dutchmen, Dutch people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bring us your slightly worn furs.
If you just want to send us patterns of ones and zeros and you don't care about the physical shells and beads, you can send us those at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. If you want to send us actual 21st century wampum, by which I mean dollars, pounds, and euros, there is a way to support the show. Isn't this good news for them, John? There's
it
a way to support
is.
The show that way. You can use Patreon to pledge your support at patreon.com/omnibusproject. It'll keep the show profitable and therefore in existence. Because even though I'm saying it's an educational thing, if this was a money-losing proposition, we would drop it in a heartbeat.
Support the show.
So if you're able to, what a wonderful gesture that would be. And what a great feeling of accomplishment and participation you'd have. The enjoyment of as a consumer you would have when you listen to the monthly addenda show or receive the other perks of membership. Thank you for the 1 in 20 of you, roughly, who support the show. It's... you know, you're the true fans.
That's true. Also, if you do have any vintage wampum, really old wampum that was collected by your Dutch ancestors, let me encourage you to go to a local museum or tribe and find maybe the real owners of that cultural patrimony, and don't send it to us.
No, we do not want to have to do a land acknowledgement every time we open the mail.
But if you have a Pendleton jacket or some turquoise jewelry that was your great grandmother's that she bought when she was living in an artist's colony in New Mexico, by all means, send that on.
Yeah, they were just trying to con your great grandma with that stuff.
Yeah, it's not worth anything to you, but it is worth something to me.
There are communities forming around Omnibus even as we speak. You can look for the Futurelings on Facebook or Discord or Reddit. And that might be it. I might be out of things to say. I thought I had...
When does that ever happen?
I thought I had a big wampum belt of things to say in the outro, but I think I got through it all.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we are here conveying information from our distant past in a game of perpetual telephone. We hope that you will retreat into your conch shells, which you call home.
Oh, yeah. If we're speaking to Welks, maybe they find it very offensive that we've been using their corpses for money.
Well, it's not us. It was our forebears.
And really, when you think about it, it was the Lenape and the Wampanoag. And
yeah. Well,
we were just trying to fit in.
We're talking about you and I as Europeans?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, my ancestors were here then, and we're absolutely trading in wampum.
Yeah, but they didn't want
innocent.
To.
No, they were
the
innocent.
The Iroquois League made them do
it. They were 100% innocent. All they wanted was used fur.
We apologize, zebra muscles of the future.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear, which is that the Welks come rise up and eat us in oyster bars in their version of Grand Central Station. We hope that that never comes, but if it comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.